Hi, my name is Joseph Silver, an architect at Stephen George & Partners. As a newly qualified architect, I'm pleased to introduce episode 2, part 2 of our podcast, where we talk about a range of topics aimed to help architecture students during their studies and for the first few years of their career. In this episode, you'll hear from myself, Jay Sayer, Ghazal Hajjijafari, Samira Khalid, and Ross Hennigan talking about choosing the right part 3 course and the benefits of collaborative learning. We also touch upon costs and the intakes at universities.
Hi, I'm Joey Silver and I'm an architect at Stephen George & Partners, and I'm here with some of my colleagues to continue our discussion about choosing the right Part 3 course.
I'm Jay Sayer, I'm an architect and I studied Part 3 at DMU.
I'm Samira Khalid, I'm an architectural assistant and I'm studying my Part 3 at Birmingham City University.
I'm Ross Hennigan, post Part 3 and studied my Part 3 at BCU.
I'm Ghazal Hajjijafari, I'm architectural assistant and studying my Part 3 at University of Nottingham.
One thing that we touched on in our previous podcast was about the intakes on the course, which is obviously a key aspect about your decision, but something that we didn't touch on, which I'd like to go into further, is about the size of the cohort, because I studied at De Montfort University, or Leicester School of Architecture, as it's called, and I really appreciated the fact that the size of the course was quite a small group, which was only around 12. So the benefit to that is we can get in touch with the course leader easily because there's not huge amounts of people contacting them, so they are really quick at responding. And also, we didn't have to create our own small study groups or become divided. There was 12 of us, we could all set up study group meetings together and really benefit from that peer-to-peer learning and collaborative working. So we were all just one team trying to support each other, which I thought was really, really useful. But I know that Nottingham has a larger course, so how does your study group system work?
That's true. We have 6 study groups with 6 to 8 members. But my actually specific group members were really busy, and besides the assigned group task, they didn't put much contribution to other tasks like interviews, preparation for exams or PUDRs and individual assignments that I really needed at that time because I didn't study in the UK. So I really wanted to know more about the procedures and the resources and stuff. So at that time, that was really highlighted to me that the practice that you're working with, at that time it was really highlighted to me that the vitality of the practice that you're work, because I learned a lot from the mentoring group that we had in SGP and from the colleagues that they passed the Part 3 course. So, but beside that, the course director was really helpful, and the circulating the materials was excellent. Also, she circulates the useful materials from the last course because all the lectures were recorded due to COVID lockdowns.
As we were saying in our previous podcast, and it kind of ties back into course sizes, Samira.
So as I said, BCU has 2 different intakes, one's in September, one's in February. And this meant that the people starting in September, they sort of did the individual assignments. And then when we joined in February, the group all merged together. And so you had people who already had some knowledge and more people who were new to the course. And it created a bigger group, but it meant that we had a mix of people and knowledge. And the course leader sort of set up study groups based on that, and so it was a good mix. So if you were struggling as a new starter, there was people who had the knowledge to help you.
There are people who'd been on the course for a bit of a longer period that were able to kind of support you in that sense.
I also feel that learning from your peers and those around you, whether it's in the lecture room in your uni or just from others in your practice at the office, it's fundamental in our architectural education. And also it because it provides students with the opportunity to learn from one another. And I found from my own experience that larger classes offered a much less isolated learning experience with a larger pool of students to collaborate with. Since I was at the time working in a small practice and only had a small handful of colleagues to discuss some practical experience with. I found that talking with other students at BCU, particularly those from bigger practices and working on other sectors, it enriched my own critical thinking, developed my awareness gaps in my own knowledge, particularly that in relation to the Part 3 criteria. And I found that this sort of learning was way beyond the norm found within the walls of the office at work. Now, I really feel that for architecture students to succeed, I feel it's really important that we have the opportunities to learn from tutors and students from a range of practical experiences and backgrounds. From my own experience, I found that smaller classes can be maybe a bit more restricted in this way when compared to the opportunities created by large groups. So what I'm saying, at least in my opinion, is that more course intake means more people to bounce off of and sharing of different experiences and backgrounds, which help us to develop ourselves professionally. But I do get that others, particularly people in this discussion, have been able to thrive in the smaller groups.
I think it's down to personal preference. I mean, you could thrive in a small group, like you said, or you could have a bigger group and bounce off ideas. I personally am a quite introverted person, so if there's too many people in the room, I tend to just sit back and let them have the discussion, and that's not helping me study. I found that talking to my colleagues was a lot more helpful because it was one-on-one. But it doesn't even matter because they put you in study groups anyway. You've got to deal with it anyway, and it doesn't matter if you have a larger one or a smaller one.
Yeah, so at BCU, the course leader tends to put us into small study groups. But to be honest, in my intake, we sort of merged into one big group. And we had like a group chat where we were all bouncing ideas off each other. We got together to do Saturday study sessions and going through exam papers. So I didn't feel like it was isolated, and I feel like we all thrived by having that bigger group. And because everyone sort of works at different size practices, they all had different experience, so we were all able to contribute.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think it's, again, as we said, it's a very personal thing about how you thrive in these different scenarios. I know that I benefit from the smaller group, but as you said, it's nice to have a bigger combination of people to kind of draw from different experiences from.
And I would say, like, also, you get what you put in. So if you're not contributing to it, even in a smaller size, you might not be contributing, so you won't get much out of it. And it's the same for anyone. Like, if you're not contributing, you're not going to get anything out of it. So you do sort of have to just go in there, and even if you don't have the knowledge, try to learn.
As much as it's not a fault for us when we work at SUP, but costs are a massive factor when deciding, and not every practice would pay the entire cost of the course like SUP. This might be the deciding factor, because some of the courses can be about £2,000, and if you have to pay this out of your pocket, that is a lot of money to pay out of your pocket.
And also for University of Nottingham, we have to pay application fee as well.
Yeah, so actually, interestingly, that's one of the reasons that I didn't apply there. It wasn't a large fee, it's just Nottingham was meant to be a reserve for me, because I knew that I wanted to go to DMU and I didn't feel like I wanted to pay the fee just to apply. So it's dependent, obviously, on where you're working and their contribution to your Part 3, but that might be something else that you should consider.
But wherever you apply, most universities would accept you. If you've got a Part 1 and a Part 2, especially in the UK, then most universities are not going to turn you down.
Well, actually, I'm not sure if it is because of the application fee or they replied super fast, but I felt really considered and have a place on the course fast, which could help me or the international students to figure out their options and plan ahead on the course requirements.
As Part 3 is technically a postgraduate diploma, it works similarly to a master's course, so you can apply direct with the universities and apply to as many universities as you want. So you can apply at any time. This could be 10 months before intake, this could be 2 days before intake, and this could help students work within their timelines, and I think you might feel better having acceptances from 5 universities and then really researching each individual one to find which is the perfect one for you.
Yeah, so I actually applied to DMU in advance, and they didn't accept me because of my PDRs, but for BCU I applied like the week before, and I got a response the day before the course started. So even if you think you've missed the intake, you should just go for it.
Yeah, missing the intake is definitely not the end as well. You can still try and get in touch with the program leader and see if there's anything they can do. You might have just missed an induction lecture or something, so definitely don't feel like, oh, I've missed the intake and therefore it's over. Feel that you can still get in touch with them. Personal preference is the key at the end of the day, and that aligns with all of the different topics we spoke about. Intake size, cost of the course, the other factors that we mentioned. And if you don't like the structure of the course as well, that's another aspect that you should really, really consider. For example, where you take your exam, the formats of the assignments. So really do your research, because it is a really personal thing, and don't rely on necessarily what your colleagues have done to make your decision. It's as with most of your part three, it's very much on you. There is kind of a massive, huge onus placed on PDRs, and there's not huge amounts of advice on those, and they're so vital to the course. So that's definitely something that we'll look to pick up in later podcasts and try and offer that support that we didn't necessarily have when we did it.
Thank you for listening to part two of our podcast. Look out for episode 3, where we talk about the importance of PEDRs.